Again, Lamesh, on behalf of the Peace and Social Justice Show here on KZFR 90.1 FM, KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for Sacramento Valley, foothills, and beyond. Opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. Today, Peace and Social Justice Show is dedicated to the life, the time, and the laughs of Molly Amick, whose soul released on March 31st after 53 revolutions around the sun. Enjoy.
I'm here with my friend and fellow KZFR programmer, Diane Suzuki, who's put together a wonderful song right here on the curbside at Chico Farmers Market, Saturday Farmers Market. Thank you, Diane.
This is Molly's song. She was not long for this life, but she made up by shining her light bright. She was a feminist, a spiritualist, a medical intellectual, a mother, a partner, a collage artist. One way or another, she learned to know herself in love. One way or another, she learned about herself in love. She was not long for this life, but she made up by shining her light bright. She was an activist, a realist, an earth protector, a sister, a gardener, a community member. One way or another, she learned about life and loved. One way or another, she learned about life and love.
Beautiful. Thank you, Diane. All right, it's my pleasure to be here with my friend and neighbor, Ken Smith, who was also a neighbor of Molly Amick for pretty much the whole time he's lived here in Chico. And Ken is the author and writer of Making Peace with Fate, the front page feature in this week's CNR. And Ken's going to share his love, just like we did at the Farmer's Market, a little bit of words around our good friend Molly Amick.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. I just want to say, ever since my wife Kate and I, then girlfriend, now wife, Kate and I moved here in 2009, we were fortunate enough to land next door to Molly and Sterling and Atticus, and they've been great friends and kind of adoptive family to us for our entire time here. She was a consummate storyteller and just full of knowledge, always full of insight, and she was definitely somebody who I turned to when I needed advice or perspective, and even like just kept me abreast of a lot of issues and mental health and local politics and all kinds of stuff that was just really important and has been really important to my experience here in Chico. And I miss her terribly, but also having kind of been close to her the last several years of her journey, I think that I've never met anybody who is more informed, more spiritually prepared, more just more equipped to deal with being terminally ill and accepting her ultimate fate and making the best of her final days. And I think that that's something that's really important in our society, and maybe we've lost some connection with death, and Molly felt it very closely, and I hope part of my article's focus is to convey that philosophy.
I'm Molly Amick. I'm going to start out that I grew up in State College, Pennsylvania, which is right in the center of the state of Pennsylvania. It's a old farming area, rural. State College is the town around Penn State University. It's old Appalachian mountains with a lot of valleys in between it, so a lot of farming. Both my parents were eventually, my father was raised on a series of two farms, and I'll get into their background a bit. My parents were solidly middle class. My mom was a visiting nurse who went back to work when I was in fourth grade. My dad was a government worker for the Department of Defense. He did background security clearances. He always considered himself a public servant. Let's see, I went to State College Identity. It started out as a land grant school. So Penn State University was eventually a small one, building ag building that's still there on campus, eventually morphed into a huge corporate identity with football. Their main agro department is now based on sort of agro business model, with Monsanto being one of their main researchers. So unlike California, where you see a lot of food production that goes on here in our fertile bases, in Pennsylvania, you'll see a lot of GMO-based crops that are essentially for animal feed and export. So you drive through these beautiful old valleys, but they're really planted in alfalfa and corn and soybeans for export and for animal feed. So they're not really for food production. So Paterno's kids I went to school with, he was very accessible. He wasn't a big, we all sort of thought it was funny that he was on TV on the weekends. He lived in a modest house in College Heights. I went to school with his middle daughter, Mary. His kids all went to the Catholic elementary school. It was a white bread town. We all grew up as free range kids. You know, in the summertime, we left our house on our bicycles, told our moms, you know, our mom said, be back at 6 o'clock. Dad wants to eat before the news. So we rode around on bikes, community pool. We didn't have much adult supervision. We took care of ourselves. That was sort of the model. And I had gone to public school at that time, was well-funded by property tax. Everyone felt that they should be paying their property tax. No one had resentment against that. And it was a time when it was a liberal arts model of school. We all took science and math, English and social studies, but we all were expected to take a language and music and art, as well as home ec and shop through the eighth grade. So that was the model. We all got that through school. When I said white bread town, I don't think my parents would have considered themselves racist, but you know, it certainly was a racist town. We had probably one family, the Washingtons, who were the major African-American families in town. It's become more diverse with the grad school now, but I remember when I was in sixth grade, Jim Washington invited me to go ice skating on Friday night, and my mother had a cowl and told me that I'd get a reputation, and I was made to call Jim and tell him that I had to turn down the invitation to go ice skating. And then later on, I sort of remember there was someone selling a house in the neighborhood and a black family was being considered for it. And then there was a neighborhood meeting and just with that seller to just advise him that it wouldn't be a good fit for the community neighborhood if a black family moved in. So, you know, what was ideal for our family probably wasn't ideal for any minority living there. It's probably gotten better now for them. My own parents grew up together in a small town of Nazareth, Pennsylvania, which is down around Allentown and Bethlehem. My dad was an only child born to two parents who had been living in Charleston, West Virginia, very southern model. His mom had a problem, you know, the whole idea of sharing a changing room with anyone of color was sort of beyond her concept. And my grandfather was definitely racist. My father's parents divorced when he was 12 years old. And at that time, I think we forget how divorce was a huge anomaly. Nobody had divorced kids. Nobody was divorced. So he moved back to Pennsylvania with his mom to her family's farm. And he was sort of looked at as a disability. It was a disability kid. You sort of talked behind the shadows about being a divorced kid. It was almost a handicap, big thing. And he and my mom, you know, went through the small school. My mom's parents, her father was first generation from a small town in Austria, which makes me laugh, it's sort of about immigrants. My sister has some stuff about immigrants from Mexico coming back and forth and taking money away. And I go, well, Mick, our own grandfather came back and forth many times on the boat, took money back to his family in the little town in Austria until he got my grandmother pregnant, and then he stayed here in this country. She was second generation from Hungary, so I still have relatives in Hungary, and we suspect that her family got out of there because they were Jewish. They never practiced any religion, never said anything about it. The women just took on the religion of the men they married, and they never really talked about it at all. So my own parents, my mom did the one, three things that were open to women at that time, which was be a nurse, go teach, or get married. And her father was just enamored by the public school system here. In Europe, you had to pay for public high school after eighth grade. So what happened to a lot of women, like my grandmother, my mom's mom, is that she had to drop out of school to go to work to pay for the boys' education for public high school. And the oldest son always got sent to public high school because he inherited the farm and needed the business training. So my grandfather was just enamored that you could go to public school here for free and really encouraged his daughters to go to school. So my mom went to nursing school. Her middle sister became a teacher, and her youngest sister did the marriage thing, much to the disappointment of my grandfather. My mom did a diploma nursing program, which is quite interesting. We sort of forget what that is. The diploma nursing was based on actually getting real life training from the hospital. So you didn't go to school. You went to the hospital, who had dormitories for women, and you lived at the hospital. They had curfews. You had to come in at 10 o'clock. And you worked the floor with patient care, but you also did everything else. You did the laundry, you made the meals, you sharpened the needles, you cleaned all the bedpans. So you were actually free labor for the hospital, and that's why the whole labor fights later on moving into an education standard for nursing was such a fight and is so crucial today for wages in being recognized as a professional. So that model of living at the hospital also happened with doctors. So doctors actually lived in housing around the hospital, little company housing with their family. And you'll see that in Oroville at the old behavioral health building that was a hospital back on Mono Drive. You'll see those five houses where the doctors who worked at the hospital used to live with their families. So sort of an older, interesting model of what used to happen in our healthcare system. Anyways, from there, my father, you know, he's always said Nazareth High School, you know, educated people for the mills to work there. So when he first graduated, he got out, went to work for the paper mill, and was working online with a guy who had been there for 40 years. And he was like, after a while, going, I can't believe that this is going to be my life for 40 years. So he actually walked down to the local college, which was Moravian College, a little private college, and said, how do I sign up for college? And what's a major? So that's how he got into college. Parents sort of had this young dream of being a doctor nurse team. So he started off in biology. He eventually went into a year of grad school, hated biology, hated what he was doing, and eventually was relieved to be drafted on the end of Korea. And he decided that he didn't want to see action because he was a coward, and he wanted to go to the smartest place that he could in the military, so he decided on investigations, and that's how he got into security background. So in order to do that, you have to have great analytical skills, and you have to have great people skills. My father had an abuse history with his parents and sort of alcohol problems his whole life, but was pretty functional with it. Wouldn't know a feeling word if he fell over it, but was a great analyzer of skills. And the only person that could synthesize information, he really gave me an analytical background. So I'll give you an example. When Colin Powell came out on TV and did his whole spiel about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, my father immediately called me after the speech and said, the man's lying. He doesn't believe a word he's saying.
Peace and Social Justice made possible generous contributions, KZFR supporters, and by the famous Blue Peace House in Chico. Looking for accommodations for friends or family? The famous Blue Peace House is a quiet, peaceful home in the heart of Chico that sleeps up to six with a kitchen stocked with basic supplies, a redwood deck, grass, gas grill, and herb and veggie gardens. More information at the famous Blue Peace House on Facebook, Airbnb Chico, or by calling Steve, 588-3549. And by Elements Yoga, offering that yoga, massage, and classes, including aerial yoga, swing, and acro yoga. The mission at Elements Yoga is to offer a healing and fitness sanctuary where anyone can fly. Do more for yourself at Elements Yoga, 1929 Mangrove Avenue in Chico, and at elementsyoga.com. You're listening to the Molly Amick Tribute here on KZFR 90.1 FM. We plan to upload the entire one-hour Molly Amick portrait as a video link for viewing, along with the first segment of Molly's Cancer Talks. Molly passed before we were able to completely cover her multi-part talk series, and we plan to air a Cancer Talk program specifically around those interviews on August 10th here on the Peace and Social Justice Show, including recordings that Ken Smith and I had gathered in the last weeks of Molly Amick's life. And I'm really pleased to turn the mic over to my dear friend and neighbor, Sterling Ogden, to add some words around Molly Amick.
Well, when you're listening here to Molly, and the more you're going to learn about Molly, and you're going to learn a lot about Molly this week. She's in the news and review. If you come to the memorial, you'll learn a lot more about her. And as Bill said, on the 10th, I'm going to talk about her again. You realize what a great loss, not only personally it was, but the loss to the community by not having Molly here. Molly did plan on running for city council this year, and she was going to make some changes, I'm certain of it, due to her policy-focused approach. But Molly and I purposely planned this remembrance, this soul release dance party, several months after she died, so that the main part of our mourning could be over, the main part of our tears could be over, and instead we could dance and celebrate the life that she was. And because Molly's was, though very serious, and we could expect great things out of Molly, she was a lot of fun. And Molly, in fact, planned the second part of this party. Yeah, I mean, the second part of the event today, which is a party that will feature Black Fong and Smokey the Groove. The moon will be up. Molly was definitely a woman of the moon. She died on the second blue moon of the year, which only happens once every 19 years. 19 years ago, her son was born, and she got the job she was most proud of, being a mother. And her favorite song was Chrissy Hynde's I'm a Mother with the Pretenders. So Molly was a woman of the moon and a mother. And tonight on the full moon, with the eclipse, which normally brings a blood moon, we don't need to see it. It's going to be smoky. We're going to have a blood moon tonight. Mars, with the worst storm ever right after Molly died that's ever been recorded, is the reddest it's ever been. We are going, all these cosmological aspects of Molly are going to bring us together in the most amazing celebration Chico has ever had. That's the way I feel about it, because that's my goal. So come on and join us tonight.
It's going to be a joy to behold. I'm really looking forward to experiencing the memorial and then the soul release afterwards.
A remembrance.
Remembrance.
Not a memorial. The memorial soul and funeral is gone. It's a remembrance.
Remembering.
And a celebration.
Molly Amick. For the rest of the show, I had a really good time with my friend Sterling here, who's the partner of Molly Amick. And we did some wonderful interviews at Chico Farmers Market. Hello, Saturday Farmers Market. But I had a lot of material on Molly, as if some folks may know. But I really focused on, she does some beautiful words around her early cancer diagnosis when she was 14. So that's kind of interspersed, kind of bringing Molly back to the conversation as we're talking to the folks at the farmer's market, which she loved dearly, here on People Power Radio.
Yeah, I'm actually at one of Molly's favorite spots at the farmer's market, sitting in the stools that Robert Spear and Bobby put out here with their coffee cart. And I'm here with some of her friends, Herb and Kevin Durkin. What do you got to say, Herb, about Molly?
So when I was thinking about Molly just now, the phrase that came up in my mind was fearlessly facing reality. When I first encountered Molly, she was a health worker, and she was telling how if she made a recommendation to a client or patient, if they didn't follow her recommendation, she said, well, oh well, that's their business. And I got a deep sense of the respect for the individual. So that's my best image of Molly, deep respect for the individual.
And that's a pretty special skill to have as a psychiatric nurse practitioner, because if you kind of take that pain on, going, hey, they didn't do what I asked them to do, it's hurting them, you know, that kind of hurts your soul as well, don't you think?
That was the point, yes. Yeah. And she was excellent at just taking life on and not overreacting.
Thank you, Herb. Kevin Durkin, brother Kev, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Bill.
What do you got, Kevin Durkin?
Well, Molly allowed her creativity to go into those metaphysical realms too. Like she did artwork based on the tarot in a lot of ways. And she was always optimistic in the positive sense that either she was going to beat her illness or she was going to go down with enlightened dignity. And she really taught me a good way to go. You know, like, she went in leaving her body in the most positive reference of celebrating life, having parties, making community, dealing with her husband and lover in, you know, very real ways in her own terms, and her son. Always having something to give, always being present in a way that was kind, in a way that was candid, honest, and authentic. What a gift. Thank you, Molly.
I'm here with Robert Spear, and we're going to talk about a mutual respect and love for Molly Amick.
I was just thinking about Molly the other day. The big thing for me was that she never allowed being sick to get in the way of her personhood, her sense of being alive. That was an incredible role model for all of us, because half of disease is depression. That feeling that you carry that you're just not all there. She never allowed that, and I really respected that. And plus, Molly was a wonderful letter writer. She carried her point of view very well and helped all of us express ourselves by feeling strongly about things and being able to speak our minds. So I wrote in my little book, and I just found it the other day, Much to Be Missed.
Since we're in a little tribe of KZFR lovers, I've never met anyone that appreciated or supported the station any more than Molly Amick did. Any words around that, Robert Spear?
Well, yeah, I think we all want to support our local radio station. We've all done our part to help keep it alive and happy, and I think we will continue.
Molly not only was a regular supporter, we always gave at least $300, sometimes up to $1,000 a year to KZFR, but she was also a frequent guest on people's shows. And she sounded pretty good on the radio. She was a much sought out guest when it came to political commentary.
You know, as a journalist, I don't know if I ever ran into a better storyteller than Molly Amick. What do you think about that, Robert?
I've heard some good stories from Molly. She was here at the market, at the holding court, at the coffee cart, and some years, many years. And so, always a participant, always lots to say and lots to share. So I think that's an important part of her legacy.
Definitely. her Saturday market was her getaway, her political meeting, her community meeting. This is really where she felt her community came together, was here at the market.
And don't forget the ukulele plunking.
Oh, yeah.
Here's Molly Amick describing her leukemia diagnosis at the age of 14.
In ninth grade, it was right before my 14th birthday in December, I woke up and I had, in the morning before school, and I had extreme intense pain in my right lower side. My mom, being a nurse, called our primary care, who at that time was a generalist. Everyone was a generalist. You did surgeries along with being primary care. He met us at the office, said, "Oh, you have appendicitis. Come on over to the hospital and we'll meet you over there and take care of it." So I went over there. Pain was pretty intense. They gave me a shot. And when I woke up the next morning, I hadn't had an appendicitis. They told me my labs were really off. I had no red blood cells. They couldn't figure out how I was being a long-distance runner of 10 miles a day, and that my white count was totally off, and it looked like I had acute lymphatic leukemia. And my first thought was, oh my God, John Capillary's brother. John Capillary at the time was a big football star, and there had just been a recent TV movie about his brother dying from leukemia from it. And that was my first thought that went through. And then I guess my other thought was nothing to do with spirituality. I just sort of had a thought that, this wasn't really my time to go.
All right. Molly Amick, it's wonderful to hear your voice, Molly. And if you're enjoying this program as nearly as much as I am, you can go right now to kzfr.org and tip the show. And as we've mentioned at least once or twice in this segment, Molly and her husband Sterling were just and remain huge, huge supporter of People Powered Radio. And Sterling's got a few things to add to our conversation here on People Powered Radio.
Oh, a couple more things about Molly that these interviews are reminding me of. Molly was a lifelong feminist, and much of her work, much of her collage work does not just represent the themes of death, but also the themes of life. One of them is her last piece, The World of All Knowing, in which it's her commentary on the Christian repression of the knowledge and wisdom of women. So Molly, she went out of this world with a bang. And when she talks about her disease and she talked about the leukemia, this is one of the reasons Molly and I planned a celebration. Because Molly wasn't real saddened about the fact that she was going to die. It was not good news for her, and it was tough news for her and the whole family. But once she got a handle on it, then she said, you know what? I've had 37, 36 years at the time, and it actually ended up being 39 years since she had leukemia. And she said, I got 39 years that a whole lot of other people that were in that hospital with me did not get. And she said, and I used every one of them, and she did.
Yeah, she led her life after a diagnosis kind of going, hey, I got things to do. Right? I got things to do.
Oh, she came out of that hospital bed with leukemia like a fireball, and she planned. Funny thing about the farmer's market is she said the whole time she had leukemia and was getting chemotherapy, all she would crave fresh fruits and vegetables. So it became no surprise that she was at the farmer's market every Saturday, and that's where most of our food came from. And then after that, she just, how many lifetimes did that woman live in those 39 years? I can't tell you. I mean, she went to Africa and produced a movie that helped stop sending money to men who were using it to get venereal diseases and instead sent it to the women who were actually doing the work on the fields and in producing goods so that they could survive in Kenya. You know, and then she ate her way across Spain, and then she lived in Japan, and then she got 3 master's degrees, and I can't tell you, I could talk about her forever, but she just had more lives in those 39 years than many of us could have in 100.
Yeah, it's nice to bring this back to some more farmers market interviews. and here on People Powered Radio. Thanks for tuning in.
All right, I'm here with Chris, longtime friend, a family friend of Molly and Atticus and Sterling, and they shared a space at the market side by side when Sterling used to have a booth down here. But Chris has got some beautiful words to say around a good friend of all of ours, Molly Amick.
I met Molly when Van and Atticus were young and started playing together at the market. Molly was quite a community person. She believed in supporting everyone locally, and so that's how I met her. She started buying bread from us every week because our children played together. And fascinating thing about Molly is she really taught me a lot of things. And Molly was actually 8 days older than me. So we share the same birth year, the same birth month. So, of course, obviously, I'm devastated that she's gone. But on a more positive note, Molly had this great ability to laugh at herself, which was amazing to me because, you know, she would go through all this diversity because she had a very stressful job, if you think about it, being a nurse practitioner, then she was raising Atticus on her own. And she just had this incredible way to laugh about things. So that's the one thing I'm still trying to learn to do. So she's just an incredible person that way. You know, we went backpacking together. She taught Van how to ski. I had no patience. She took him up on the bunny hill. Come on, Van, do this. And told him just what to do. We've gone backpacking together. And Molly, she was something. She took us on this, we're gonna bushwhack and find the PCT trail. Yeah, right. Through the snowbank, walking, all day long walking and snow. So of course we didn't find the PCT. And then turn it around when we take her to the Trinities and we start doing the bushwhack. Oh, my knees are hurting. Well, oh well, Molly. Yeah, she was a character in a good way. So we had some good laughs, some good times together. And, you know, rest in peace, Molly.
Charles Withune, activist. We were first involved with Charles probably with Chico Tree Advocates and Career Builders. And here he is doing Simplicity Village. And Molly was a great resource for him, I think.
I always felt better when Molly was in the room. Many times we'd be organizing and in a group, Chico Avenues Neighborhood Association, and people were being kind of tepid and being in paralysis by analysis and not really making much progress. And Molly would walk in the room and I would breathe a sigh of relief and she would tear the place apart. You guys get your butt in gear. This is a problem. Let's go after it. This is how we can do it. You actually have more power than you're giving yourselves credit for. Let's get something done here. And I would just go, wow, way to go, Molly.
You know, Molly intended on running for the city council this year. Molly was a policy wonk. Yeah, we had a life plan. She was going to run for city council this year, and it was all about rewriting policies to help the homeless, with code enforcement, with other things. She just was a policy wonk, and she was so ready to get in here and rewrite policy. And that Canaan Neighborhood Association was a great experience in that direction.
Can you imagine a city council with Molly and Tammy Ritter and Scott Huber and a few others? Wow, we could have an amazing rewrite of policy with people like that in power. And to hear you speak about Molly that way just gets me. I hope that we can impart her activism and her vision to the new people that get elected.
So I'm here at the Farmer's Market. We're going to be talking with Ann Schwab about her good friend, our good friend, Molly Amick. Maybe just a prompt for you, Ann. I know Molly told me several times how she was excited before her illness to be thinking about running for city council.
Molly was a passionate woman who combined with her wit and knowledge of our community would have made an outstanding city council member. Molly and I talked policy and about her running for Chico City Council, and I encourage her to do so. Certainly our community's loss. In Molly's lifetime, she gave a lot to our city, to her community in the Canaan Neighborhood Association, and she's the inspiration Forrest on how to live a civically engaged life.
All right. Tell us your name and are your good words about Molly Amick, our good friend.
Hi, my name is Beth Sisk. And Molly, I've probably known for the last maybe 5 years. But one thing I think about Molly, I think, what a force to be reckoned with. For one, an amazing mind, so interested in so many things, and so wanting to be involved and put input into things. I mean, remember, it was probably a month or so before her death, she's talking about, I need to talk to them about the city infill and the parking situation. I need to go talk to the city. Or her saying, I want to start having people off the street come and have dinner with us. For one, just, I was always impressed by Molly's interest in things, willingness to share information, help people out. Also, what a playful spirit, dressing up in her lederhosen for whatever, the Oktoberfest, or her little fairy wings I got the other day that she had for Halloween. I mean, just, yes, willing to engage in life and be playful. And also so self-reflective, always trying to grow and do a better job of whatever she was doing, you know. And even at the end here, had let go of her job, done all this traveling with Sterling, and she was telling me about how she helped her mother pass and just a whole little ritual she did with her mother, lighting all these beautiful royal blue candles, her mother's favorite color, and helping her mother just be in this wonderful space before she passed.
All right, I'm here with David Sisk, a.k.a. Sisko, and thank you for sharing some words around our good friend Molly Amick.
Molly was quite a number. She had a kind of a proper streak, but then she would foil that completely by cursing. You know, she would just find that she was just frustrated and couldn't come up with the words, and she would just say, well, I won't say them now because this is going to apparently be on the radio, but you'd have to bleep it, you know. But she would just be talking along and then all of a sudden just saying, those damn whatever, you know, but it would be more than that, you know. And she just really would get pissed off. And I really enjoyed her spunk. I really enjoyed her spunk. She had a certain quality about her that was just indomitable, you know, like you couldn't keep her enthusiasm down, you know. And I don't have a whole lot, I didn't have stories like Beth has about personal encounters with her, but I just remember being in conversations with her and her just being so attentive to what this world needed, you know. Here she is in Chico, California, in the middle of the Trump era, and she was just like unrelenting in her desire and her will to change things to the way they should be, you know.
I had a quote that kind of went like this. Molly had me hooked even before her first well-placed F-bomb.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, it was just kind of amazing. She was a nurse, and she was kind of proper looking in a way, but just she had a mouth, you know, that couldn't be suppressed.
All right, you folks just tuning in. We are airing a Molly Amick tribute show. Be sure to get down to the Chico Women's Club tonight. They're doing a whole soul remembrance and soul release for Molly. And then this next segment's going to be a continuing of Molly discussing, you know, her diagnosis and her travels through having leukemia at the age of 14 here on Peepaw Radio.
In State College, the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, had already earmarked State College as a blip on the screen for childhood leukemias for an elevated rate. And interesting enough, a subsidiary of Dow Chemical at the time had polluted one of the best trout fishing streams that went through Pennsylvania at that time, Spring Creek. And presidents used to come fish that, Roosevelt up in the Poconos, things like that. And one of the little tributaries that came off of that ran through State College. And as kids, we had always ridden our bikes, swam there, fished there, spent time. And that little tributary wasn't posted for PCB contamination until well after I was out of college. So in an interesting aside that you'll see a lot of times that's still not in cancer data is those background pollution sites. So remember, in Orrville, we have 3 Superfund sites and a CDC blip for pancreatic cancer.
This is Christy, one of Molly's favorite persons. We've done a lot of laughing together, a lot of talking together, and we've bought many of her beautiful things.
My very first memory of Molly is coming to the farmer's market. It was my first day setting my booth up about 5.5 years ago, and I was so nervous that nobody was going to buy anything from me. Molly was my first customer. She bought my very first piece of pottery that I sold here at the farmer's market, and that really warmed my heart. I'll never forget that. Made my day, and she just continued to show so much love and so much support through the years, through hard times, through fun times. Just always such a positive spirit and beautiful soul.
She loved the artisans. I can say she was definitely a pottery fan by looking in her cupboards.
Yeah, I loved going to her house and just walking around and seeing everything. Yeah. It's beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting that Christy brought that up, because I realized that Molly was many artists' first buyers.
Actions speak what's on your heart, and Molly was a person of action, huh?
Well, I have to tell you this. She never bought a piece of art unless she thought she were going to be a successful artist, though.
Oh, I like that.
That's so sweet. Love Molly.
I'm here with Robin from Sweet Cottage, and she's just got some wonderful words to say around our good friend Molly Amick.
Well, first of all, we will miss her dearly in this time. I hold Molly in my heart and where she's gone to, as I know she's returned home. Just looking at her last piece of art and knowing how she came into this world and how her beautiful son Atticus came into this world, circled around the moon, everything just seemed to fall into place in my mind for her. She just came right when she was supposed to and left sooner than we would like her to, but on her scheduled time. Just looking at her beautiful art that she did healed my heart for her, and not getting to experience her here in this time right now. Molly was a beautiful woman. She cared and loved so many people and brought so much kindness to us here. We will miss her dearly. And we just love you, Molly.
And won't it be so beautiful? Just in a few hours, we'll be down at the Soul Release Memorial and dance party. And there's going to be a whole bunch of her art there. That's going to be just wonderful, won't it?
Absolutely. I encourage anyone to come and honor her time with us, to honor her art, and all of the people that got to experience her, and just to celebrate her journey and where she's going and how we got to experience her here when she was here.
At that point, we had 2 choices. We could stay in State College and be treated by the local oncologist, or we could become part of one of the first outcome studies that was being done through Stanford Hospital and funded by the Carter Administration for Leukemia. And Children's Hospital in Pittsburgh was participating in that, and that's where we would go for our care. So outcome studies mean that all your data is put into a data bank, a computer, and that decisions are made on what looks like the best, most efficient treatment plans. So it's not based on the biases of your provider, it's based on outcome data. And that was sort of a new model at that time, and being funded, completely funded, all the meds under the Carter administration.
All right, you're listening to Molly Amick talking about her life growing up. And you can check out the full interview, because I sat down with Molly and she had it all laid out, you know, and I've got the whole 1 hour, and you can actually see her gorgeous and beautiful face. You know, if there was anyone that was looking for outcomes in this lifetime and work towards that, it was our dear friend Molly Amick. Peace and Social Justice Show, made possible, generous contributions, KZFR supporters, and by Chico News and Review, providing Northern California with news, commentary, and entertainment. The Chico News and Review is available for free every Thursday at over 600 locations throughout Butte, Glen, and Tehama counties, and at newsreview.com. And by Rhymes with Give, Live Life Juice Company, providing locally fresh cold-pressed juices and elixirs. Find the Live Life Juice Company at Wednesday and Saturday Chico Farmers Market and at their storefront, 220 Broadway. Open weekdays, 9 to 7, Saturdays, 10 to 5, Sundays, 10 to 4. More information, livelifejuiceco.com, and on Facebook. And also a phone number, 866-336-3346. Live Life Juice Company, pure fresh juice. Drink to your health. We're gonna transition a little bit, because as we've talked, myself and many others of how Molly was a person of action, I can't remember a conversation of any breadth or length where Molly wasn't talking about, her experience with the behavioral health system. And we're here to talk a little bit about, someone that tragically died on the streets, homeless, as a behavioral health client. Behavioral health, if you're part of behavioral health client, quote unquote, Butte County, that means you're severely mentally ill and you're on Medi-Cal. But we're gonna have some words around Tyler Stevens. This is an interview I did. It's going to be front-ended with Sianna Suniki, who did some wonderful work with Tyler. Huge shout-out to you, Sianna. She got him his first pair of glasses. And then we're going to transition from there to some words from Robert Trausch, who knew Tyler quite well through Chico Housing Action Team. And then we have a few folks in the studio that we're going to, kind of end the show talking about, hey, what the heck should we do about the situation of so many folks without a place to live and just suffering on the streets here on People Powered Radio. Maybe you could just share a little bit. We're using a street named Ty, but a little bit about the process and how much better he's doing having someone champion for him.
The family was really, he was in jail for about 6 months, and then the family took him in. But, after the 6 years of him being homeless after high school and in and out of jail and losing him for a while, everybody's not only emotionally tapped, but, scared that they're going to lose him again. And, what's interesting about it is that when you meet him, you know that there is some mental illness going on, perhaps some developmental delay, definitely not functioning at a level that you or I would be, but he has no diagnosis. And so he's been navigating this entire system and world by himself with no diagnosis, no medication, just really, really, really underserved there. Another thing, we took him to get an eye exam, and it turns out he's legally blind and been walking around without glasses for years.
I'm here with Tyler, man, and we talked about his story and how he got his glasses legally blind. Welcome to KZFR, Tyler.
Nice to meet you.
Now, why is housing so important to you, man? Give us one word to describe that, and then why.
Oh, housing is important because sometimes people don't have a right to live on the street. So, and then the housing program makes it available for people who don't have a right to live on the street.
Mm-hmm. How neat is it to have a champion? You actually, Lloyd Pendleton talked a lot about champions. You've got your own champion in Sienna, Soniki. How's that been going for you? How big of a deal has that been for you, Tyler?
It's doing well for me. I just got a program going with housing, and it's available, so maybe certain circumstances end up my way, please.
And it helps having a beautiful aunt like Tammy Donaldson.
All right, it's my pleasure. I have Robert Trausch from Chico Housing Action Team here on a pre-record. And Robert's just going to say some words around Tyler Stevens, and he's got some really powerful words to say around our mental health system here in Butte County. Welcome to KZFR, Bob Trausch.
Thank you so much, Bill, for having me. Yeah, we had Tyler. We really worked so hard with Tyler. He was such a really nice kid, especially when he was on medication. But like so many people who have mental illness, when they're off of medication, they don't really understand. They don't have the ability to understand what's going on in their life. And the system tends to work backwards. It actually punishes people like that. They wait until they make a big mistake rather than treating them early or allowing a family to say, hey, this person needs help. And then they punish him. They take him to jail. They send him to Atascadero or some other place where they force him on medicine. Then they bring him back and prosecute them or maybe persecute them because of their mental illness. So our system works backwards. Rather than saying, hey, this person has a problem, we have to work with it now, or a parent saying, my son or daughter has a problem, and we need to respond to it, instead of that, we wait until something major happens, and then we punish them, and then we force them on medication, and again, we prosecute and put them in jail. I know that from my own experience with my own children, my own life, and that's so unfortunate that it works backwards. A kid like Tyler should have had services from the state, from the federal government, taking care of him, understanding he had a problem that he couldn't deal with, that he wasn't aware of. When you're in a state like he is, or anyone with mental illness, when they're off of medication and need to be medicated, need services, need to have an understanding of their mental illness, we don't respond to it until a big mistake is made. And that's why something like, from my perspective, Laura Law is so important, because Laura's Law allows parents or people who love you to say, my son or daughter or my niece or nephew is in trauma and they can't see a way out. They don't have the ability to reason, to understand they need help. I want them to have help. And we don't have that in Butte County. And in most places, we don't have laws like that. It's been taken away from us. We've given all the authority to someone who can't reason. And we need to change the law, and we need to have the police force also look at differently, and the courts look differently at how we treat the people who have these illnesses.
You know, one thing I've seen since I got involved in this almost 7 years ago, Bob, is, you know, when you look at a behavioral health client, they have this infamous, you know, when they're looking at whether he should be released from a puff or a temporary hold, are they a threat to themselves or others, and can they take care of themselves? I really think we need to push the fact, if they know the person is mentally ill and they've been acting out and they're going to go live homeless on the street, well, they're certainly not able to take care of themselves. And as we saw in the case of Tyler and many others, Bob, they certainly are a risk to themselves and others living on a dangerous street with no shelter.
Absolutely. And the reality of the system, there's not enough money there. So you get sent to behavioral health. And what do you get? You get maybe 3 days in there. You get a cocktail that knocks you out. It takes a really long time to understand your mental illness. It takes a really long time to change the brain patterns to allow you to understand that better. And instead of doing that, we stick someone in there. We don't have the resources. We have not enough beds, not enough staff. So you get 3 days max in most cases, and you're back out in the street. You've been medicated enough to knock you out where they can say, well, you're not a danger to yourself and others. Now you can go back out in the street. And exactly what you're saying. On the street, there's predators. There's people there that can take advantage of you. You obviously can't take care of yourself. If you could, you wouldn't be in that situation in the first place. And it's just, like I say, our system seems to run backwards at this point.
All right, back in the studio, and it's my real pleasure to be turning this conversation over to continue the conversation around Tyler Stevens and his story and the behavioral health system in general. I have Lisa Currier from Crisis Care Advocacy and Triage. Welcome to KZFR, Lisa.
Hi, Bill. So, you know, this is a beautiful beautiful tribute to Molly previous to that, but the most how it transitions right now is wonderful as a nurse practitioner, yeah, and an advocate for those, you know, out daily. And she was someone who accepted people as they are and where they came from. So what we're talking about now is another tragedy, a 26-year-old gentleman, and I mean a gentleman, passed away 2 weeks ago. Now I'm going to tell you the story on how that started. You know, in the beginning of March, mid-March, I think it was around the 13th or the 16th, Tyler came home. He used to be housed at Harmony House, the house I previously managed for people suffering mental illness, right? And he came home with scratches and cuts and a broken thumb, and took him to the hospital and asked him what was happening. He doesn't remember what happened. He said he crashed his bike. The story changed. We had noticed that he had started to go into a different types of behavior, and he was starting to burn himself. He was starting to be in some form of psychosis where he just couldn't manage. So his aunt Tammy and I, on the 16th of March, took him to behavioral health. Of course, we all know with mental illness that these folks can actually turn it around and say, you know, no, I'm housed, I can eat, I can do these things. And so if they're not saying that they can't take care of themselves, or they're not a threat to themselves or others, then, you know, they send them away. So on the 17th, you know, Tyler called me and said that he was having a problem. And on the 19th and the 21st, Tammy took him over. Tammy and I both drove him over to Butte Behavioral Health because he was in crisis and he wanted to go. So this is not a man. This is a previously homeless man since he was 16 years old, and finally got housed after you heard the piece with Sienna in the beginning of January, the beginning of January, not this one, the year before. So he was housed with us. He was taking his medications. He was happy to work at the garden. He was a joyful soul and happy to help others, right? Mm-hmm. So it was really kind of nice. So we had taken him. We had noticed that he was in the psychosis. I watched him daily, went over there daily, and Tammy and I checked in with him. He also checked in with his grandparents, who were fully supportive of him. This is not someone who didn't have wraparound services. This is a blatant disregard for human life when we took him over to behavioral health. So not only that, but we took him over to behavioral health on, it was the 17th, the 21st, the 27th. He had an appointment with behavioral health on the 28th, which we all encompassed Tyler in his meeting, which was his grandmother, Tammy and I, and Tyler. And we were all talking about what's going on with Tyler, and Tyler actually was showing signs of his psychosis in the meeting. Right?
Yeah.
And so what happened was is they decided to 5150 him, and then he said, you know, the hell, and he ran out. And so they came and they got him. They took him over. They picked him up. They took him over to Enloe for the second part of the triage for 5150. And what happened was they cut him loose. He had a plan. He had a plan to go to the tourist shelter, eat a banana, and if the tourist shelter wouldn't let him in because he wasn't allowed there, then he was going to go to the library.
Now, but his original plan was to go down to a bed in Yuba City, correct? A psychiatric bed.
Well, he was supposed
to go there.
They
right?
were the hold, the behavioral health was putting him on a hold, and when she kicked him, he came back to the house, and he lashed out at one of the residents. Hence, he lost his housing, and so then he became homeless again. And it's a tragic loss. We're checking in with him every day. He was at his grandmother's, you know, when we were trying to figure out what's the best state to get him to and how to, everybody would check on him. And and what are we going to do? And so 2 weeks ago, he was climbing in a fence, and he got caught up, and he bled out from his artery broken, on a fence. There is no reason, and I'm going to say it, there's no reason in hell that this child was homeless. It was a blatant disregard for how we, how we're doing intake. We need to get more experienced street people and people who understand mental illness a little bit better than these intake people.
Yeah, nice segue to thank you so much for that, Lisa.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for sharing those words. And I met with Tyler. I was part of his support network, maybe not daily, but certainly on monthly. And I'm going to kick it off here to Sterling to kind of end the show talking about, you know, using MHA, Mental Health Services Act money, Butte County Behavioral Health money, to house homeless folks so they have shelter and they're not on the street being a behavioral health client.
About 16 years ago, the voters of California, passed a resolution, passed a proposition that tax millionaires 1% to provide new, unique mental health services. And let me tell you, when you're talking about mental health and you're talking about stress, anybody can become mentally ill once they're under stress. And there is nothing more stressful than not having a home. There is a fund that is collecting billions and billions of dollars at the state level that we are not using. Let's go get that MHSA money, reduce everybody's stress, and prevent mental health problems in this county by giving the homeless people a house.
Thank you, Sterling. And we got another minute here. Lisa, do you have anything to add on what you would like to see change right now if you could snap your freaking fingers?
Snap my fingers, Bill. What would happen was 10 teams of two, an advocate and a social worker every single day. Laura's Law passed, which is, again, let's research this, people. And this is not a forced medication, nor is it a forced court system. It's a wraparound effect. So crisis care, triage, and advocacy is happy to help anyone in mental health crisis. The number is 510-396-5109. And we would be happy to join to have wraparound services. These people need that. In addition to, I think it's we need more money for proper triage and the funding for behavioral health. I mean, you know, these people are only take Medi-Cal and it's selective. If, you know, they only take so many, you can only fit so many in the 14 beds that they have.
Yeah. All right. I want to thank everyone, each and every person that was involved in putting together this program. And, huge shout out to Ken Smith. I'll give him an extra shout out for that wonderful front page feature. And get to CNR this week and, you know, check out that wonderful writing of Ken Smith, you know, honoring Molly Amick. And be sure to get down to the Women's Club tonight, you know, for the soul release. Take care, everyone. And thanks for listening to Peak Power Radio. Next up. Playing Dead here on KZFR 90.1 FM.